Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeta, Evan Basilek, Russell Young, and Sujeet DeMello discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information, should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 212, being recorded on the 17th of January, 2018. I'm Sujeet, and on Skype with me, I have Kale and Evan. It's the three of us back together again. Looking at some of the recent updates that we have in the Azure space, I don't know, I got the feeling it was a dry week, right? I even looked up the Azure blog, and there wasn't much this in the past week or two.
I'm telling you, everybody is still recovering from the holidays and backlog there, and then planned maintenance. I'm sure they will pick back up in another couple of weeks, and we'll be, you know, overwhelmed again.
However, having said that, there are a couple of good ones in here, at least two or three good ones in here. So let's get right to it. I don't know, Evan.
I got to talk about this one. So, Kale, I love you, man, but it's getting ridiculous here. I was driving home the other day, and I listened, to the Marketplace on NPR's podcast on the way home just to catch up with what went on. I like the show, and at the end of it, they talk about hey, we're gonna blockchain is just the coolest thing, and it's everybody wants to use it, and it's got all these positives, and so they're gonna rename themselves to Market Blockchain Place, and so I can't even go home on my drive home to relax a little bit, and listen to the news without hearing about blockchain.
Yeah, we were talking about this before the show, but you sprinkle a little blockchain name on anything and the stock price goes up. So it's the mantra now. I hope that the tech shines through because the tech is super awesome, and this little hype thing will eventually calm down. But it's not bad to have the name being talked about, so that's good.
Yeah, exactly.
But Kale, it's we had that flurry of announcements and whatnot, and then I don't know. I mean, am I wrong in thinking that it's been a bit dry in the blockchain space off late?
No, I mean, there's a lot of stuff coming. So, there's a lot of waves of stuff inside Microsoft as well as outside. With our partners, I work very closely with our third parties. And, they run in these waves. If you look at, public Ethereum's roadmap, there is a backlog of things that are coming to fruition here. So it's going to be like a wave. And then it will take us time to kind of absorb that and make it production and do those kind of things. But ZK Snarks with the privacy stuff, the sharding stuff that's coming out, the scaling. I mean, there's a very big focus. I mean, Vitalik just made a comment today on the internet that, there's a lot of hype in 2017, to your point about, the blockchain name being on everything. And he's been pretty critical about, what have we delivered? To be honest, right? So we have a lot of good stuff here. We have a lot of potential. And then statement, if you go check it out on the internet today, was, he basically said, I think 2018 will be the year we actually bring, and he named specific things like scaling for blockchain and things like that to fruition. So, I'm bullish on it. I think it's 2018 is going to be awesome for blockchain. It's, get through this hype stuff. But I think, it runs in waves just like anything.
But isn't that, that's kind of what you see typically, right? There's the initial, hey, this is cool. It's the new shiny, right, for a little while. And then people, the ones that are just playing with it kind of go on and do something else. But the ones that really see a business proposition or a technical value that it brings, right, go off, and it takes them some time to build what they're going to build. And you need certain fundamental capabilities. And then it really starts exponentially growing at that point, right? So I think you guys are probably in that lull here where – The hype is wearing off, and to your point, right now people are off delivering kind of some of the needs to actually build things on top of it that are going to really knock everybody's socks off.
Yeah, I think when it becomes like we're not talking about it anymore, it's just like electricity.
Yeah, it's just part of it.
That's when it's awesome, That's we're in that curve now, just like you said. So yeah, totally in sync with that.
Very cool. Well, Kale, what do you like in the recent round of updates now that Evan's stolen your thunder?
No worries. The one I wanted to talk about, maybe you guys can enlighten me a little bit actually on this one. So there was a good blog post out here from the Azure Stack team about this IP advantage So this Azure IP Advantage now covers workloads that are in Azure Stack, and it's some sort of IP indemnification for Azure services with like a portfolio of like tons of patents on open source software. I'm just wondering, like, what does that mean exactly? Do you guys have any insight into that? Because I'm a little bit lost with this one, but it sounds pretty awesome. I don't know what it means.
I can't remember if we talked about it with somebody on the show or whether we, you know, just kind of were looking at it when this was first announced. But, you know, we've had this for public Azure for, I don't know, a couple years, something like that. Mm-hmm. And basically, it's exactly what you said, Kale, right? We basically say if you develop something on Azure, then we will put the entire support of all of our patent portfolio, all of our IP, intellectual property portfolio, behind you to say that somebody can't come by and sue you just because, you know, you're when you're running on the platform.
Nice.
Right? And by expanding this to Azure Stack, again, I mean, that's one of these things, right? You see the reason companies like Microsoft and they buy all these patents and whatnot and they collect them is, I mean, sometimes they're looking for ways to monetize them, but a lot of times they're looking to protect themselves, right, against somebody coming by and saying, well, you know, hey, this was my idea 10 years ago, so now you owe me $1 billion. Right? And by providing this to all of our customers, it gives them access to that same portfolio without having to own all the patents and buy all the patents like we've got.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. And I mean, obviously, you know, if you have an application that's using other stuff, they can't cover you for that. That's you're on your own over there, right? This is just for the base. What's in the platform itself?
We'll have to go back and double check. It might be good to get somebody from that team together to talk about, you know, exactly kind of where that boundary is.
We should bring a lawyer on the podcast.
Yes, there you go. Always need a lawyer. No, I mean, I'm just thinking this like a little logically. Like if I write an application which, you know, uses a bunch of third-party tools and I run it on Azure, I could be infringing on something, right?
If you're using third-party stuff, but I think the concept is if you just kind of develop from scratch.
Right.
But you're protected in that sense.
But the actual, like, for example, if you run it on functions, for example, right, the underlying functions code is obviously going to be protected. No one's going to come and say, oh, you know, the functions was using this IP that I owned, and now you owe me money for it. They can't say that. Yeah.
Right. You know, but I think it's neat that we've extended this to Azure Stack. I'm not quite sure that I'm sure there's a good business value proposition, but it is interesting that we're extending that, in essence, to on-premises workloads.
I mean, it kind of makes sense to me, I guess, just thinking, like, I mean, I'm not even close to being a lawyer or anything around that. And licensing sometimes scares me a little. We just got to be careful with it. But, like, I'm thinking, like, you know, as the catalog of Azure, you know, all the stuff we have in Marketplace, basically, as all those things become, you know, kind of lit up in Azure Stack, this seems natural to me. I mean, it seems like it would be, like, we need that, right?
Right. And you know, it's been a while since we talked about the Azure Stack, but that's more than just companies doing it on premises, right? It's also partners.
Yep.
There's a big partner ecosystem, and so they could be using Azure Stack to offer a SaaS solution of some sort, right? And then obviously, that protection has to be extended through that program that you just talked of.
Yep,
that's a good one. All right, I found one which I really like. You know, we talked about the Cloud Shell. A while ago, we did a show on it, and now they've just taken that whole thing to a completely different level, which is, I was just playing around with it before the show. So now you could take the Cloud Shell. It used to be that, you know, there's a little button in the portal, and it would bring up this little window at the bottom of your portal, kind of a narrow or a very not a lot of space where you could issue some commands and whatnot. And now they've expanded that to a generic URL. So there's different ways you can access the Cloud Shell now. For example, you could just say shell.azure/PowerShell. Anybody, you can do from anywhere. Obviously, you authenticate which Azure account you want to use, and then it gives you this full screen, lovely interface, which is nothing but the PowerShell script, you know, engine. Same with /bash. You could, of course, even access it from the little Windows, I mean, the Android app that you have, or iOS app for Azure. You could also get a little shell over there. And, of course, you can even embed it in your own application if you need to somehow, you know, embed a link to the Cloud Shell. There's a little button you can add in there. And then finally, they've even added to VS Code. So in VS Code, now you can install one of the extensions, which is a Cloud Shell extension. And right from VS Code itself, you can have a little bash window connected to your Azure portal.
That's awesome. I didn't know about that VS Code thing, by the way. I think that's amazing.
Yeah.
Because like zero install, right? It's super
It
awesome.
is, yeah. I mean, it really works really nice. I tried both the PowerShell and the Bash versions, and they work great. So definitely recommend everyone takes a look at that. And then we got one more item on the list today.
Yeah, let me talk about this one because this is kind of, one of my traditional areas. But, so network security groups, this is what you use to protect your resources. You can say, you can define the tuple, so, protocol, port, source and destination IP, and decide whether or not you want to allow or deny, specific traffic. The problem with this has always been that that was always IP address based, right, and port based. So, well, what if I want to talk about storage, or what if I want to talk about Azure, where those things technically don't have static IPs. I mean, you'll see that they tend to be fairly static over long periods of time, but they can change and change do can and do change at any time. So we had put it in preview, I don't know what, maybe 6 months ago or something like that, where you could now basically define by name, by service tags, you could define NSGs to say, allow this VM to go to storage. Right, I don't care what the storage IP is, but allow this resource to go to storage or go to Azure SQL DB. We've GA'd this capability, and I think we've even, I was looking, it looks like we've added a couple of tags that weren't there the last time I had looked as well. And I know from, kind of hearing from the team and that supports this, that we've got plans to have even more tags as we go, right? This is kind of the direction that the service teams are going, rather than publishing this list of, hey, you must allow these ports and these protocols and, inbound and outbound, is they're going to say, hey, allow this service tag, and then you can use Azure Active Directory domain services, or allow this service tag, and you can use Azure SQL DB with
How
your flows.
does that work, Evan? Like, so that sounds really cool, because like I could see a company saying, we have SQL servers in these specific regions, but the US ones can only talk to the ones in the UK or other regions. So that's kind of cool. But my question is like on the I'm thinking about it from the diagnostic side. So, we'll still have traditional NSGs, right? The
Yes.
normal ones. So when we go like, okay, how do we troubleshoot this? Like, what if somebody actually denies one? How does it show up? Like, how does somebody troubleshoot that? 'Cause does it show up like part of the NSG, the normal inbound
Yeah,
rules?
it'll show up as a standard NSG when you look at them. I mean,
Oh,
again, they're
cool.
t it's I mean, if you look at the way the source and destination, it's almost, think about it like you're putting in a name instead of an IP,
Right.
right?
Cool. Right.
When you're defining that. And now I haven't looked to see how it shows up in the NSG diagnostics. I was looking at those the other day with one of the engineers, but I suspect it'll show up the same way, right? Because you'll see your source and destination in your logging, and so in this case, you'll just see a destination. I suspect you would see a destination of storage,
And
right?
then if like it was like if all of a sudden we're like, hey, why isn't this talking? We could just see that it's being denied by this rule, and then we could trace that
Yes,
rule and all that. Yeah.
exactly. Yeah,
Okay. Cool.
exactly. Yeah,
And this is really huge. I know my customer, every time, we'd have to put in I've mentioned before how they have like sometimes 400 to 500 rules in some of their services, and each one of them has these plethora of IP addresses, right? And they'll ask me, okay, I need all the IP addresses for Key Vault, all the IP addresses for storage, and then we have to go and hunt down the PM and get all those IP addresses, and then as you said, if they change, then that's it. It's everyone's running around. So this is actually very, very critical for that. But I want to put a caveat though. A lot of these service tags only work with the resource manager ARM resources.
Correct. Yeah.
My customer unfortunately is using a lot of PaaS resources, which are still the ASM model or the RDFE model. And so that's something that customers should watch out for. If you are using PaaS, you won't be able to use all these service tags.
Yeah, good point. Yeah. I don't know. I'll probably upset some PM somewhere, but ASM and classic stuff is, we're no question that we're not getting rid of any of that by any stretch. But it's very clear that when we come up with new features, new functionality, it's going to be on the ARM stuff. Going forward, that's just unfortunately the reality.
So one other question about these NSGs, Evan, how do people do them? Like how do, so it's GA now, right? So how do they, is it just when you go in to define a new role, now this is another option in that dialogue, or how does it work?
That's a good question. I'm not exactly sure what this ends up looking like in the dialogue, but I mean, it used to be, right, you had load balancer was one of the kind of like the original tags, right? Azure load balancer. So I would expect it to show up in the same fashion.
Cool.
That I think that was part of the dropdowns at that point. So I would expect these to show up the exact same way.
Cool.
Yep, and Azure Load Balancer was one of the tags supported in ESM, which was good.
Yes. Yeah.
But yeah, that's a good question, Gail. All right, that's a good round of updates. So let's talk about the main topic today. Evan has been rather busy off late.
I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah, we had all this planned maintenance come through, and one of the things, right, irrespective of why it was done, the reality is that, reboots are a fact of life in the IT world, right? Servers go down, maintenance has to occur, right? Be it on the Azure platform, be it on your on-premises world, doesn't really matter, right? So there's, building that high availability has always been a challenge. I don't know about you guys, but I remember many crits and when I was working in the SQL Server space where someone's called and says, "Hey, my primary site went down and we tried to fail over to our disaster recovery site and it didn't work." Right? Now we're all running around trying to get that up and running, and meanwhile their site's down, and this is supposed to be their disaster recovery solution, and it doesn't work, right? That's a big deal. So when you look at Azure, one of the big value propositions that Azure provides is it provides all kinds of ways to do high availability, right? We've got availability sets, availability zones or regions. I think it's regions is what we call it. We've got the ability to do PaaS services. We've got SaaS services. We've got all the different things. So I thought it would be a good conversation to kind of talk about and say, hey, if you're starting from scratch, this is kind of the things to think about and the services that you're likely going to consider. If you're doing IaaS and you're doing more of a IaaS implementation, there's a different set of services you're likely to consider. And then if you're doing a lift and shift scenario where you're just literally picking something up from on-premises, where you're a little bit more constrained, there are some other things that you can use under that scenario as well.
That's where it's very good. And just to be clear, I mean, the problem that you had to deal with in the past few weeks was a lot of the VMs getting restarted, right, for the most part.
Correct. Yeah, mostly, almost all IaaS, or almost exclusively IaaS.
Right.
And that was where, I mean, I think that was, it was, I don't want to say it's funny because I certainly am not laughing at the amount of time and effort everybody put into this, I guess in hindsight. But, one of the things that I've heard repeatedly from customers since then is, yeah, the redesign that we were going to do to add high availability to this app, or the, removing this single point of failure that we kept delaying and kept delaying and kept delaying, it just didn't seem important. They think that's pretty important now. And so it's really kind of reinvigorated the conversation with a lot of customers that I talk to about, hey,
Yep.
What are the capabilities and what should I be doing for this stuff?
And I think you're right. There is the I think part of the problem is just too many options, right? Almost.
Yeah.
And just picking the right ones, what's best for me for my scenario is not always straightforward.
Right. Oh well, so given that, so I mean, where do you guys want to start? You want to start talking about like a greenfield type one, and then kind of talk about some of the options there, or do you want to start on the other side of things, kind of the polar opposite of a lift and shift type scenario?
Yeah, I think the lift and shift is good because that's, usually that's what happens first, right?
Right.
People are moving some of their stuff to the cloud, and then they quickly realize, like, oh, wait, I wasn't high available before, and now I have this option, so that's kind of cool. So I'd like to see it approach from there, if you don't mind, and then kind of work up to, because greenfield is awesome because you got all kinds of options because there's no kind
Right.
of restraints there. But like when it's really constrained, when it's like, okay, it has to work with these certain things, I'd like to, maybe if we could start there.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's a good place to start because I think that's the hardest one to do, right? Because you're trying to kind of shoehorn in this high availability without having to redesign the whole app, right? I mean, I guess if you think about it, there's the way I typically look at it is there's kind of some different tiers, right? You've got your front end, which is typically some sort of stateless, piece web servers or service endpoints, things like that. Then you've got your kind of middle tier, which is where all your application processing happens, and then you've got probably your data tier on the back end. And each of them are a little bit different. I mean, in my experience, front end's actually the easiest, right? I mean, web servers are the original pets. I'm sorry, not pets. Web servers are the original cattle. you don't care about a web server, right? You copy the config files over, you copy over your web pages, your resources, and then you spin that thing up behind a load balancer and you're done.
They're supposed to be stateless for the most part,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And stateless is great because I can scale up, I can scale down, I can have multiples. If I have to throw one away, I do that. Just stick it behind a load balancer and you're mostly done, right, at that point. Although it does raise the question of, a lot of them do have some concept of state. And so that brings in, if I've got, what's the IIS feature for state? State server?
State server, yeah.
Yeah, so, I don't know the high availability story for that offhand. Do you guys?
I don't think it does. You have to use, one of the SQL or the Redis or one of the other state servers.
The other thing call out there is like what I've run into with the lift and shifts. I think we talked about this before in the podcast is like people go, yeah, that's fine. We'll go ahead and just like set that up. We can set up like three or four of them. How many do you have now? One. Okay, that's cool. Like, and then you get it up there and find out that it's writing to the file system. And then
right.
Oh, crap. That's not good. Now we have to either replicate that thing or change the app. So, because we can't keep those things in sync anymore,
Oh, when you're trying to scale out, you're saying at that point.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, I do think when you do this stuff, it does have to be an actual thoughtful process, right?
Yep.
Because you can't just scale them out and then just hope it works. You are going to run into some things like you're talking about, right? Where they write into the file system and you just don't, you have to make some code changes. But ideally, they're small,
yep.
Right? I write to a Azure file share instead of a local disk, right? Should be transparent to the application. At that point, or theoretically, right, exchanging out Redis for, Azure State Server. Again, not trivial, but also not awful at that point.
Yeah, you'd hope you're not rewriting code over that, because if they just used a provider, you can hopefully
right.
kind of retrofit that thing, and then you don't really have to change much code. But yeah.
Yes.
And that brings the other benefit, too, when you do those kind of things, like, we'll talk about the Azure Files, because I was playing around with that this weekend. Now you're using a PaaS service for your SMB shares. And then you don't even care what's underneath that, right? You just pick up all this extra reliability without doing anything, right? So anytime you can swap in a little piece, a tiny little piece of your app for a PaaS service, I think that's really kind of like a huge win at that point.
Yep, agreed.
So that's kind of the front end. So let's talk about what I think is probably the hardest stuff, which is your data tier, right? Data's hard because how do you get multiple copies of your data? You really can't, at least using traditional sources. And so you end up doing, like SQL Server has always-on availability groups. I don't know if either of you guys have used them before, but it still is only one. I mean, it's two copies of your data. And we're syncing the data between, but now you have to make some decisions about high availability and high performance, right? Do I want to fail over? Do I want to delay my fail? Do I want to delay my transactions, making sure that both copies have any one transaction? Or do I want to run the risk that if I have to fail over, one side is missing a transaction?
Yeah, I think the hardest thing here, and Evan, you're really close to this, so I think it'd be great. And I think this would be great if we put a couple of links in the linked up about this. But the question I always get about databases and mm-hmm. backends for these things are like, okay, we're using SQL Server. So let's say they are using SQL Server. Which one do I use? So that becomes the question.
You're talking like SQL Azure versus SQL
Azure. SQL Azure versus SQL IaaS. And then when we even, let's say it's in IaaS, what's all this RTO, RPO, like all these different kind of versions of SQL and like different flavors we have there to kind of support exactly what you're talking about.
I think that's this goes back to the statement I said before about swapping a PaaS service whenever you can. These days, with Azure SQL DB being so close in feature parity with SQL Server running on an IaaS VM, if I have a choice between SQL Server running on an IaaS VM and Azure SQL DB, I'm going Azure SQL DB every day. Because if I get, you know, if my T-SQL doesn't have to change, my connection string doesn't, you know, maybe all that changes is my connection string. I don't lose any functionality. I'm not using, you know, there is some things that don't exist in Azure SQL DB. But if I'm not using those, which again, 80 to 90% of the user base for SQL Server doesn't use those, the fancier features like that. You know, that's like just copy your data, but you export your database, import it to Azure SQL DB, change your connection string, boom, you're up and running, and now you don't have to manage your SQL Server anymore.
Yep.
Right? Because I don't know if you have either of you guys ever tried to set up Always On?
Yeah, it's quite an undertaking.
Yeah. Isn't it, though?
I mean, I think it takes like two or three consultants on site to set it up. Yeah.
Or an ARM template these days.
Yeah. I think that, you know, to your previous point, so not all customers, right, are ready to move to SQL Azure. My customer is a case in point. They feel that there is some sort of still a risk with the SQL Azure, which is, you know, I guess part of the unknown, right?
I guess some of their data.
The multi-tenanted version.
Yeah, exactly.
And so they're still not comfortable with putting the crown jewels on SQL Azure as yet. So that's something that, you know, customers are going to have to deal with. And so the lift and shift is going to be the most obvious one, right? I have SQL Server running on my server on-premises, and I want to put it in Azure. And what's the best way for me to do that?
Yep. I mean, SQL Server running on an IaaS VM runs great. And you know, now our comments about like setting up your, you know, always on, you know, it's much, much easier to do in Azure. We've got an ARM template that allows you to do it. I used to talk to people, their DR site was like these really stripped down versions of their primary site, right? Because who could afford to have a server on the other side of your DR that's just as big as your production server, right? But you're never using it. Right, that just kind of from a cost perspective, never seemed to work. Now, you know, great, I have these other servers. Maybe I have them, they're smaller, so that I maybe have to resize them when I do my failover or shortly after I do my failover. But I don't have this capacity that's sitting there unused,
right,
in quite the same fashion that the other stuff was. At that point, I say it a little bit, you know, nonchalantly, but in some ways it's really true. I mean, it's just SQL Server,
mm-hmm.
right? And so somebody like your customer, Sajid, who's, you know, not quite comfortable going to SQL Azure, right, they're going to be with things that they're very comfortable, but now they don't have to worry about managing their SAN.
Yeah.
Right? They don't have to worry about managing their network in the same fashion. Again, they lose some of the complexity by, adding in, you know, where they don't have to worry about the infrastructure piece.
They've got a complicated SQL Server layout now, like two nodes in one region, two nodes in another region, everything's all connected. It's complicated. But
And imagine doing that in the on-premises world, right?
Yeah.
I mean, even for a large, you know, multi-region, multinational company, right, that's non-trivial to do.
So, Jade, as you come over there, I mean, first off, we can raise their stock price alone just by saying they're using blockchain. We can just use that then. Just kidding.
So what should folks that are doing the lift and shift, right, like what should they be doing when they put it to Azure to make it a little more resilient, let's say? Okay, one is to try and, if possible, move it to SQL Azure, right? That's the best case scenario, if they can do that, because then they get the automatic redundancy, correct?
Yeah, but I would even go, I mean, I'd start with SQL Server, right? If that's what you know, that's what you're comfortable with, right? Absolutely start there. But immediately start looking at, can I do always on, right? Can I make that work in my environment? You know, can I leverage the stuff? Because now you have, like, so it's like one of the things the planned maintenance really drove home for a lot of customers was that if I have a single point of failure, a single server that runs my workload, it is the controlling factor as far as whether or not my workload is up, right? I was talking to a customer who had a single SQL Server that serviced multiple applications. Mm. And while that SQL Server was down, they had four or five different apps that were down, right? When they're looking at lift and shift, I mean, a couple of things to think about, right? Can you do always on? Can you split your SQL Servers into multiple deployments, right? Can I separate out my apps based on, you know, each SQL server, each instance gets a different SQL server, right? We see this a lot, you know, where we now kind of, we had this phase on premises where we're trying to stuff as much onto a single physical host as we could, into a single virtual machine as we could. Now you're seeing people go the other way and saying, hey, I want kind of single use virtual machine, so I don't have to worry about application incompatibility and those kind of things, kind of like containers, right? But just doing it with VMs. You know, if put your, make sure when you've got your two instances, make sure you've got them in an availability set, right? That's huge, right? Availability sets guarantee that only one of those nodes will we ever take down at one time for maintenance. Also, we guarantee that with the fault domains, the way fault domains work, if you've got N VMs in an availability set, we guarantee that, you know, a certain percentage of those are guaranteed to be in different physical racks, right? So if we have a, you know, some sort of rack level failure, you're not going to lose your entire app, right? So take advantage of the availability sets. To your point, Sajid, right? If you can, do multi-region,
right?
Right. If you don't need to have everything in one region, maybe in one region, maybe you don't.
Is that what availability zones does for you, though? The multi, does that take?
Yeah, that's really, I mean, another.
That's different data centers, right? That's the zone is a data center, right?
Yeah, it's all within one region,
right?
But it's different zones. But yeah, I mean, I think what that really is you could kind of think about it like it's an availability set across data centers.
Yep.
Right. And we guarantee that, again, we're gonna honor kind of availability zones when we talk about, you know, doing reboots and doing updates and the like from that point. This is maybe just one common mistake that I see people do. Don't put your entire application in one availability set, right? Put your similar servers in the same availability set, but don't put your database, your front end, your applications here. Don't put them all in one availability set. And people make that mistake, right? I think they kind of think of it like a logical grouping. And then they find out that, oh, well, we'll take one down, and then a little bit later we'll take the other one down, and then a little bit later we'll take the third one down. Meanwhile, your entire app is struggling from that point.
Right. Right.
I think the other one we didn't talk about too much here, like we've been talking about relational, but like, you know, NoSQL's been out for a while now in various forms, you know, MongoDB, some of the open source stuff, and then, you know, obviously we have the cloud, you know, DocDB and Azure Tables and things like that. So, like, it seems like for those ones, it's a little bit easier to move to the cloud.
You go to Cosmos, right? If you're doing DocDB, go straight to Cosmos, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just thinking if they're running like Mongo or something on-prem, we have those Mongo kind of extensions or whatever for Cosmo, and basically don't even need to change the app. You can just like point over there, same protocol, and you're off to the races. So it feels like the NoSQL, at least in my eyes, is a much easier migration or move to the cloud than you know, a typical relational type database.
I think it depends on what you use application-wise, right? I mean, if you're using kind of the mainline SQL, I think it's just as easy to move. If you're using some of the fancier SQL, T-SQL stuff, then yeah, absolutely, it's more problematic. I think NoSQL and the like, I think they tend to have a kind of a, like, regardless of where you're running, they have the same feature set, right? So it is a little bit easier to move that. Do you guys know, I mean, I haven't looked closely at the Cosmos DB, DocDB, or Mongo APIs, but like, is it really and truly, you know, drop in place as is, or are there some subtle differences there that you have to watch out for?
You mean switching between the protocols? Is that what you meant?
Well, no. So if you're doing, let's say you're doing, let's say you're doing DocDB today.
Yeah.
And then you decide you want to do Cosmos or you want to do Mongo, because there's a Mongo API for, or the equivalent, whatever the
right, right. Cosmos is more like an umbrella, right, or name for the whole thing. It's the choices are really DocDB, Cosmos DB, or GraphDB, or table storage, right? Those are the four choices.
Right.
But the Cosmos DB is just an umbrella term for all of them together. So your choices are between DocDB and MongoDB, ideally. GraphDB is obviously totally different, right? It's a graph database.
Right.
And then table is essentially just name value pairs.
So, I mean, essentially, they've implemented a protocol. To your point, Evan, like, so Mongo's got a specific protocol. So, if you're using Mongo, there is a version, like, it says we support this version or whatever. So, like, if you support at least that version or whatever, yeah, it's like kind of feature parity. I get this feeling, and I haven't run into this personally, but there's probably some exotic Mongo stuff, like SQL Server, where you can do some things that are a little bit more crazy, and potentially they could only be done on-prem, but I can't think of any off the top of my head that I've seen.
Well, it's probably like we were saying earlier, right? The 80-20 rule,
Yeah.
right? You know,
Yeah.
80 or 90% of the people don't use that stuff.
Yep.
I'm trying to think of some of the other big ones that that I keep running into, and I really, it's interesting because it's the same design patterns over and over, right? It's plug in some PaaS or SaaS services where you can. It's is there a cloud equivalent to what you're doing at, SQL Server, Azure CD, or Mongo and Cosmos, right? That allows an easy plug in. And beyond that, it's make sure you don't have a single server anywhere. But
What about SAN storage? Would they use Azure Files for that?
I mean, anything you're doing SMB stuff, I mean, Azure Files seems like a natural plugin. I mean, heck, I didn't realize you could do this. It used to be that you couldn't do SMB shares from on-premises. Well, now with the later versions of Windows, you can do SMB shares to Azure Files from on-prem as well as Azure.
That's nice.
Right. So like now I don't need that file server anymore. But I think that's the way to look at it. I think people get hung up a little bit on, well, I want to be able to touch my VM. I want to be able to touch my server, right? Remote into it and look at stuff. But if you kind of get yourself out of that habit, I think you really quickly see even a lift and shift, there's all kinds of opportunity to remove pieces of the app. You'll probably not be able to, refactor the whole thing, but pieces of it can go.
Right. So that's a good recipe, right, that you outlined, like starting from the front, try to go, I mean, make sure you're stateless, right, as far as possible. But as you said, there's no such thing as true stateless. All applications have state at some point, and that state can get persisted in some sort of a repository like a Redis cache or a SQL Server database, if that may be the case. And you clearly outlined how you can make that more resilient to any of these reboots. And then we talked about the files. What else? I think that should cover a good portion of them. Yes, Gail?
I think the other thing I wanted to mention, so like, I mean, I know Evan's deep in this, and from where I sit, we've been involved with this a little bit on the, how Azure has kind of evolved from a reliability standpoint. Not just saying like we're really good at running servers, but the standpoint of like how many
Yes, we
nulls and
are,
DALs.
but
Well, I mean, except for Evan's group, no.
hey, wait a minute.
No, just kidding. But no, I'm thinking more like the features that we've kind of lit up. I mean, that's kind of unsung hero work. We talk about that a lot in the podcast, but that really is just like Azure Monitor. It's like we have these features now where you can kind of schedule the maintenance cycles and
Yes.
the enhancements we've made just to make sure the VMs actually just don't go down. Or not even like not go down, but like when we do maintenance, getting to the point where we almost no don't have any reboots or very,
Yep.
very infrequent ones, as
Yep.
opposed to, years ago, it seemed like every couple
Tuesdays,
months,
right?
yeah.
Every Tuesday, right? Or every 1 month, every Tuesday once a month.
Yeah. So I think there's been like big strides made there, and those guys really deserve a hand. I mean, in the business continuity reliability team at Azure to do that stuff and the new features. So I would recommend people who haven't looked at that stuff, like being able to like even just like kind of schedule what reboot me now, these kind of things,
Right.
like different
Right.
things. Super big feature set there to take advantage of so you can kind of plan for, ultimately, as you said, Evan, these things need to be patched. I mean, it's going to happen. So like
Yeah.
making that as low as possible is the goal, right?
I mean, I heard a comment the other day in one of my internal meetings where, and I don't remember what, I mean, this was a little bit tongue in cheek, which was, we've done a ton of work over the last few years to make sure that, we get rid of basically the software bugs. Right. I mean, hardware's always going to fail, right? Hardware is hardware, right? There's going to be some failure rate. But we've gotten rid of a lot of the software stuff, but the hardware stuff is still there. And so the additional the additional nines that customers are going to get is going to come out of doing the right design for the application, right? Doing the right availability set, doing, you know, making sure you're leveraging a, you know, plugging in a PaaS service where you can just to take away a piece of your app, because that's the only way you're going to get that extra level of reliability that people are really pushing for, that, you know, that next nine in essence, right? You're just not going to get it out of the platform getting better, right? Because there's only so much the platform can do at that point.
Great. Good stuff, Evan. Thanks so much for your insights into that area. Well, I guess we'll put some of those resources in the show notes, Cale, that you mentioned, and hopefully our listeners will get something out of it. I mean, the one thing that I guess we should also add on to this discussion is, you know, Microsoft does put out these kind of alerts, right, warning people to schedule your reboots. And I guess as consumers, we should be heeding those alerts, I guess, right, and taking action on them, as opposed to just waiting for the last minute and then it all gets scrunched up in a short window of time. So that's the other thing is, you know, when Microsoft does put out these warnings or alerts, is to, you know, take some action on them as soon as possible and not wait. Hopefully that's something they can keep an eye on. All right, great. Well, thanks a lot, guys. Appreciate all those insights. And we'll see you guys next week.
Sounds good. Talk to you guys later.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.